Hey, I'm Brian Stelter. This is Reliable Sources. We are covering the story behind the story, so let's get right to it. Aides from both the Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders campaigns will join me live. Plus, why Chris Matthews suddenly stepped down from MSNBC. And why President Trump's campaign is suing several news outlets, including CNN. Is this a re-election strategy? Lots to get to, but first, lying and leadership breakdowns when it comes to the coronavirus. We are at a critical moment with governments around the world taking action and companies canceling travel and cities calling off big public gatherings. Every hour, every day, you can feel the spread of the virus and the spread of the quarantines. The scope of this story, frankly, is it's hard to get your arms around. That is a challenge for newsrooms like this one and many others. Right now, we need clear-eyed, no-nonsense news coverage during this crisis. Just consider where we are versus a week ago. This time last Sunday, there were 89 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the United States. Half of those were from the Diamond Princess cruise ship. Now, there are at least 450, according to CNN's count. This count's being updated constantly. And the truth is, no one knows the exact or full number because of testing failures. That's why these kinds of headlines are important to make clear about what's going on. Health officials are sounding alarms because they don't have enough test kits. This story says the flawed rollout of tests has snowballed into an embarrassing fiasco of national proportions. Politico's lead headline, go to politico.com right now, it says Trump's mismanagement helped fuel the coronavirus crisis. The Washington Post says Trump administration has squandered time and lost control. But let's just pause on this. We've seen this before. The other day, the New York Times said Trump has dealt with the coronavirus, quote, the first external crisis of his administration by repeating a string of falsehoods. Falsehoods, yes, but this is not the first crisis of his administration. Category 5 Hurricane Maria ravaged Puerto Rico in September 2017. And the similarities between the responses are glaring. As news coverage conveyed the scope of the crisis in Puerto Rico, the government's sluggish response was being scrutinized by the press. What did Trump do? He doubled down, he defended himself, and he lashed out at others for their shortcomings. He downplayed the death toll and outright rejected the math and accused Democrats of trying to make him look bad. He said he was the best thing to ever happen to Puerto Rico. So in both cases, Maria then and the coronavirus now, we are seeing wild boosterism and bogus claims. They are abounding. We've seen bewildering photo ops showing off the government's response. We've seen people at the epicenter trying to point out failures in the response. And we've seen stories exposing how government agencies were underprepared and ill-prepared. These stories are crucial. Journalists play a key role right now in putting pressure on local and federal governments and exposing flaws in the response. Journalists are spreading word about people who believe they are infected who are not getting help. These are signs of a healthy news ecosystem. But the U.S. president, of course, perceives this as a bad thing. He says in a brand new tweet, the fake news media is doing everything in order to make the U.S. look bad, make us look bad, he says. In the tweet, Trump is still patting himself on the back for restricting travel from China, something that happened weeks ago. But we are so far past that point right now. The virus is spreading rapidly in the United States. But Trump is doing things that undermine the response. He is continuing to contradict health experts, like by saying that anybody can get a test, which is not true right now. It's not true. His behavior at the CDC on Friday spoke volumes about his mindset. He wore a campaign hat to this event. He asked about Fox's ratings. He insulted the Democratic governor of Washington State, and he brought up the Ukraine scandal. Most of the news coverage of this visit downplayed just how strange it was, and that is a problem. We've got to describe reality exactly as it actually is and not shy away from the aberrant responses that we are seeing from the commander-in-chief. That also includes his aides. Some of his aides have been out there saying this has been contained. That is a lie. Thankfully, there's been fact checks to that point. What we need to do in this moment is prioritize accurate information from experts over misinformation from politicians. You know, Trump and the news media both have a tendency to make, well, everything about Trump, right? But this virus story is only a little bit about Trump. Should he be doing things differently? Yes. For example, the CDC says older Americans should limit travel. But he's not amplifying that message. He should be right now. In fact, he can tweet about it right now. The president should lead, or else he should get out of the way. By all means, sir, please don't go out of your way to make a bad situation worse. Lead or get out of the way. Don't be an obstacle. Maybe just stay on the golf course. So, that's the story about the president. But the press should point out when he is an obstacle and then move on. Don't make it all about Trump. This story is too important for that. The health consequences are too serious. We're heading into a storm. And the mostly East Coast media needs to focus on the West Coast, on locales like Washington State, where it is already hitting hard. Let's take a look at some of the Sunday morning front pages from Washington State. This is the Sunday Herald in Everett. We'll circle through these. In Everett, saying the lack of testing is raising doubts. The Seattle Times front page is totally dedicated to the story. And the Olympian in Olympia, Washington, is quoting health experts that are saying this is a pandemic and should be declared so. So let's talk more about this now with my experts who are assembled here in New York and across the country. With me here is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, a former CDC disease detective and current director of the Stanford Health Communication Initiative, Dr. Seema Yasmin, and former U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius. I'm going to take my own advice and pivot past the president and not talk about the president right now. Seema, let's talk about the state of the crisis. Mm-hmm. What has happened in the past couple of days, and how should journalists be covering the story?
I want to shout out those local journalists that you pointed out, Brian. They are doing fantastic work on the ground in the areas hardest hit. And I think really giving their readership in those areas advice and information about what isn't happening that should be happening. And I'm really appreciating the look at how overwhelmed healthcare systems can quickly become. So the devastating news coming out of the LifeCare Center in Kirkland, just outside of Seattle, where we've seen a number of deaths. But alarmingly, we've seen that of 180 staff there, 70 are showing signs of this coronavirus infection. And of course, we're learning that what officials have been saying about, well, anyone who wants a test can get one, is not panning out to be true. And reporters are covering that story. I want to point out that emotion is not helpful when you are reporting. Mm. Emotion can get in the way. And I am starting to see reporters tweet in all caps or become very frustrated while live on air. I share those frustrations. Trust me, I'm a medical journalist. I'm a public health physician. I see what's going wrong. But as reporters, our job is to let the reporting do the talking.
Yeah, you know, right now, health experts are the heroes in this story. Reporters can just bring more attention to those health experts, help get the word out. So, Elizabeth, you're a longtime New York Times reporter, now the head of Kaiser Health News. What are your do's and don'ts for reporters right now?
Well, I think the most important thing is to put out the numbers, but put them in context. So when you say, hear the WHO saying 3.4% death rate, you say, well, yes, but only people who were really sick are mostly tested. You know, we hear the president saying, oh, I like good numbers. Well, good numbers aren't low numbers in an epidemic necessarily. It may mean, as it does in the United States, that we're not testing very well, right? South Korea has bad numbers, quote unquote, but that's largely because they're doing the right thing. They're going out and testing broadly, which will save people's lives and help them understand the outlines of this epidemic. So I think we really have to put on our science hats, go with the numbers, and make sure we always put them out there, but put them out there with the proper context.
And Kathleen Sebelius, about the tests or the lack of tests, just how big a story is this delay in getting a sufficient amount of testing?
Well, I don't think there's any question that the United States is behind on testing. And what we're doing is testing people who present themselves mostly at a hospital and are very sick. So we are not doing the kind of proactive testing. Epidemiology is really about pattern and it's about frequency. So you need to know what the pattern of the disease is, where it's spreading, how fast it's spreading, and then frequency in terms of the percentage of the population. And we really don't know either in the United States yet. That really is the kind of information that would give people some confidence about making rational decisions. We have to get the scientists out front. We have to get the scientists to tell us regularly what we know and what we don't know and how fast we can know it. And I think you made a great point earlier. Have the president stop talking. His hunches are potentially very dangerous because we don't want to rely on his hunches. We want to rely on the science. There's no way to speed up a vaccine and skip over safety and efficacy trials. So we need to have the scientists talk to the American public, and then people can begin making decisions for themselves and their families and their communities that make some sense.
The president lacks credibility. Most Americans know that. But unfortunately, millions of Americans do believe what he says when he downplays the situation. And Dr. Yasmin, that's especially true with Fox News viewers who have been told over and over again for 3 years not to trust anything else.
Yeah, and I want to point out that we think that that viewership skews older, and those are the folks that we are more worried about. Mm. And to your point, when you talk about those case fatality rates, provide the context and break it down by age group. Let's be honest that the more deaths we're seeing are in the over 70s. And so we want that viewership to really be aware. And I just want to say on the testing kit issue, it's from a journalistic perspective, it's not only a testing technical failure, it's a regulatory failure. And I want to see that reported on because that, Brian, has implications for the next epidemic and the one after. And we will be here again talking about another epidemic in a year, 5 years, I don't know when, but we need to get those red tape issue sorted out now so that we're not having the same conversations.
Let's have everybody stand by for a moment. Quick break here, and then I want to show you a graph that explains social distancing and all of this, puts it into perspective. That's in just a moment. Sometimes an infographic is worth 1,000 words. So let me show you an example. This is from the CDC explaining social distancing, the idea of mitigation when a virus is spreading. All right. So you see there's an X and a Y axis. You have this rise in daily cases and you have this number of days since the first case. The idea here is that there's no action taken, no intervention, no protective measures, you're going to get a rapid rise in the outbreak. You're going to have a lot more cases every day. If you take actions like canceling travel, avoiding public events, et cetera, then you're going to get a much slower rise in the number of cases over time, and that helps the healthcare system keep up. Let's advance this and show you how this graphic is spreading in its own way, in a good way. This is a version published by The Economist that's been going viral on social media. Again, showing if you delay the epidemic, you reduce the height of the peak of the epidemic, and thus the healthcare system is able to keep up. Again, let's advance it again and show you a version that has also been showing up on Twitter. This added line is the important part. It says healthcare system capacity. Again, the idea here is if you take a lot of protective measures, hopefully you're not overwhelming the healthcare system. These graphics have been made by a number of people on Twitter. This one is from Drew Harris, who is taking the Economist point from the CDC and then adding that healthcare capacity line. He says, this is the difference between finding an ICU bed and a ventilator or being treated in the tent in a parking lot. His point is that the healthcare system capacity is crucial. I think we should talk more about this. Let's bring our panelists back. Elizabeth Rosenthal of Kaiser Health News. When we talk about protective measures, as that graphic shows, what are those protective measures?
Well, I think the problem is people hear protective measures and they think mask and gloves, but that's not really what we're talking about for the ordinary public. We're talking about not going to tight events, maybe closing schools. When we lived through SARS in China, my kids' schools stayed open, but no kid went to school with a runny nose. They washed their hands 1,000 times a day, and no kid got SARS, and no kid got stomach flu or anything else during that time. So those issues like social distancing, hand washing, staying out of tight spaces, they make a huge difference, and we can all do those pretty easily.
So we are seeing conferences and events being canceled, events like South by Southwest that are big media events. News outlets like CNN have dramatically reduced the amount of travel that we are doing, although to a certain degree I have to cover the news, so there is some travel that continues. So Kathleen Sebelius, let me see if I get this straight. You know, we can even put this infographic back up on screen. The idea here is this virus is going to keep spreading. We've got to be honest about that. But if we can reduce the speed of the spread, then that supports the healthcare system. Is that it in a nutshell?
Well, that's an accurate picture. What, again, we tie back to testing. And I think we have to know this is a great big country. And there are going to be hotspots. Seattle, we know right now, is a hotspot. That may move. We may see bigger outbreaks in certain areas of the country than in others. We need to identify those very quickly, get out ahead of them, figure out how wide it spreads, and then take action. I think what's happening right now is people actually don't know what to do. So out of an abundance of caution, they are canceling all kinds of things. And I'm not sure that that's what the scientists would say is the best measure. Libby just outlined, you know, basic precautions that everybody should be taking: hand washing, stop shaking hands, making sure you're cleaning surfaces, those kinds of things that will make people healthier in the long run. We need to quickly start reassessing hospital capacity and making sure we have a stockpile. I was pleased to see that Congress added billions of dollars to replenish the stockpile of important equipment, ventilators and masks and for healthcare workers. But we need to really be able to map and accurately identify for business travel, for events, for schools, what is going on in the United States, what the pattern looks like, what the frequency looks like, and who is most vulnerable. Right. Then you can make decisions.
You know, speaking of this and this, the sense of reactions versus overreactions, Dr. Yasmin, you look at social media this weekend, you can find these Twitter threads and Facebook posts telling you the entire country is going to be infected in a matter of weeks or months.
Right.
Are those examples of overreactions that we have to watch out for on social media?
We do have to be careful about overreactions. We want to get the accurate information out there. There are modelers doing incredible work trying to help us build good case scenarios and also the worst case scenarios. And when we're thinking about the health system capacity, Brian, we're not just thinking about the equipment, which we're worried about, the strategic national stockpile in terms of N95 masks and things like that. We're also worried about the people who work in the healthcare system. So look at Lombardy in Italy, the area really hard hit. 10% of the doctors and nurses there tested positive. They were talking about bringing older doctors out of retirement and accelerating graduation dates for nurses. Like, that's not a position we want to get into here, which is why taking measures early on, having testing kits available, and doing all of that public health work now can make a difference in the future.
Elizabeth, final thought?
Final thought, Brian, is the numbers.
Kathleen, go ahead. You're on a little bit of a delay. Kathleen, go ahead first, and then we'll go to Elizabeth.
All I was going to say is the other thing I think we have to be telling the public right now, this is not a short-term issue. Mm-hmm. It will be a year, likely, before we have a vaccine. So this is not about March. This is about the next multiple months. We don't know if it's going to come back in the fall with a vengeance. So we need to actually prepare people, not just what they're going to do for the next 2 weeks, but what they're going to do for the next 6, 7, 8, 9 months. And I think that's an important message to start to deliver right now.
And I think it's really important for viewers to know that the cases are going to go up. The number of cases are going to rise dramatically in the U.S., and that's because we're now starting to do the kind of testing we should have been done.
Yeah.
And so when you see, you know, number of cases triples in your town or in your state, don't get alarmed right away. Think, wow, this may be a good thing because now we'll understand more about the denominator. How does this virus spread? Who needs to be worried and respond appropriately?
In news coverage, it's always about proportionality.
Right.
And that's especially true, it sounds like, in this case.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you all for being here. Much more coming up here on Reliable Sources, including a look at the Democratic primary race and what a difference a week makes in the primary season. Joe Biden now riding a high after what one aide called a tsunami of earned media. We'll talk with TJ Ducklow, National Press Secretary for the campaign, next. Welcome back to Reliable Sources. Turning to Democratic politics now and the Joe Biden campaign in frontrunner status after Super Tuesday. Now looking ahead to the next Super Tuesday, I have a guest here with me for his first CNN interview. TJ Ducklow is the National Press Secretary for the Biden campaign. TJ, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Longtime listener, first time caller.
Okay, we'll take that. That's great. Hey, you were at NBC News doing public relations before joining the Biden campaign. Yeah. What's it like now to be on the other side, going from newsroom to going to the campaign?
It's great. It's exciting. It's fun to be in the action. It's fun to be in the game.
Do you ever have gripes with NBC's coverage?
Our job is to make sure we have fair and objective coverage across the board. And so that's constantly what we're doing every day. It's been great.
In December, some viewers know this, some viewers don't. You were diagnosed with lung cancer while in the midst of this incredible campaign season. What have the last few months been like for you?
They've been hard, but they've been good. You know, I've got an incredible support network of family and friends that my team, the Biden campaign has been truly amazing. It's been great to be back at work and to sort of take my mind off things. And I mean, listen.
So you've been back for over a month at this point.
I have.
To work.
The last week has certainly made me feel better. That's for sure.
So last weekend, the South Carolina win happens. And then from my perspective, you all produced one heck of a television show.
Sure.
With these announcements of endorsements, with these big rallies ahead of Super Tuesday. How strategic was that, or was it just all luck?
Well, look, I mean, lastly, it was really a case study in earned versus paid media. It was the power of the narrative. I mean, we knew after Iowa and New Hampshire, we'd have to do well in Nevada, and then sort of use South Carolina and a strong performance there as a springboard into Super Tuesday. Look, that's exactly what we did. We got 150 endorsements over 3 days. We used that momentum, the Joe-mentum, if you will, which of course continued this morning with Senator Harris's endorsement, to, as you said, produce a television show Monday night.
And by the way, a free television show, right? Michael Bloomberg's out there buying a television show,
right,
by spending a lot of money on ads.
Right. No, I mean, between 7 o'clock and 11 o'clock on Monday night, from Mayor Pete's endorsement to Senator Klobuchar being at our rally, to the surprise guest of Congressman O'Rourke, and then the Whataburger visit. I mean, it was a blackout television, right? It was wall-to-wall Joe Biden.
Is that the strategy for this weekend now as well?
Well, look, I think the strategy is that message, which was what folks heard the night before they voted on Super Tuesday, which is that Joe Biden is the candidate to unite the Democratic Party, to bring folks along, to win down-ballot races. I mean, that is what, if you turned on your television the Monday before Super Tuesday, that is what you heard. And the other point I'll make about that is, you know, it's the message that's important and powerful, but it's also the messenger. I mean, Joe Biden is someone that folks across the country know. He's someone that, you know, has character and values, and that people know is the polar opposite of Donald Trump. I think without a messenger that is credible with a message like this, I don't think it would have been as powerful or as effective as it was.
People know Biden, but some are also worried about his cognitive decline. That's the claim we're hearing oftentimes on Fox News. Let me just show a few examples.
A rapid state of decline.
Barely functioning.
He's a doddering old man who grins a lot.
The man barely knows where he is or who he's with at any hour of the day.
He seems not to even remember what day it is.
He's not in charge, and everyone knows it.
That's one reason the other candidates were so eager to swing in behind Biden.
The party machine's geriatric puppet.
What's the Biden campaign going to do to respond to that daily drumbeat?
Well, look, Brian, Fox News and Donald Trump and his allies have been throwing everything they have at us for the last 10 months. And voters on Super Tuesday roundly rejected what they are selling. I think that this campaign has shown you over the last 10 months that we can take everything that people throw at us. We can address it head on. We can address it aggressively.
But for 8 more months, it's going to be dementia and Hunter Biden.
But we can also keep our eye on the ball, and we can walk and chew gum, and we can address those lies, because that's what they are, Brian. They're lies. They are smears. They are invented claims. We can address those claims while also talking about the issues that voters care about, things like health care, things like climate change, things like gun safety reform, the things that Joe Biden has fought for his entire career. We're prepared to do it. We've shown that we can do it, and voters have shown that they reject it. And so we're looking forward to continuing to do it into the fall.
It's going to be eight busy months.
Indeed.
TJ, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. Best of luck. Quick break here, and then we're going to turn to the Bernie Sanders campaign. You know, Sanders has a plan for the journalism business. Hear about that and more with David Sirota in just a moment.
Not what the media is writing. Don't believe what you're reading.
Turning now from Joe Biden to the other contender for the Democratic nomination for president, Bernie Sanders. He's on 4 of the Sunday shows today, making a big push ahead of Tuesday's primaries. David Sirota is joining me. He's a Bernie 2020 speechwriter and senior advisor. David, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Earlier in the week, Sanders said, "Don't believe what you hear in the media." He seemed to be bristling at some of the coverage of his campaign. He's criticized the corporate media all season long. It's actually been a trademark of his, even going back decades. What are your critiques of the news media's coverage of the Sanders campaign?
Look, the main critique is that the media often doesn't focus on the issues that are of real importance to the American people, the issues that Senator Sanders has campaigned on. Climate change, I mean, there was a recent study out that said something like 4 hours of total network coverage went to climate change over the year. Coverage of poverty, coverage of low wages in America, coverage of the health care crisis. So the critique is that a media that is owned by big corporations and billionaires is often not all that interested in covering the major issues that are not necessarily of economic importance to billionaires and corporations.
A lot of people say, "Hey, Sanders, he's attacking the media just like Trump." Now, I think he does it differently, but what do you think?
Yeah, it's not the same critique. I mean, here's the deal. Donald Trump impugns the existence of the media, makes clear he doesn't really think the media has a worthwhile role in our democracy. Bernie Sanders, who has put out a plan to protect journalism, Bernie Sanders very much believes in the free press as an integral part of our democracy. But his critique is, again, that the media often ignores the fundamentally important public policy issues that the media should be covering, and frankly, that we need the media to be covering.
You were a journalist for many years. You decided to join the campaign. Why is that? Why did you make the leap?
Because the crises we face right now, I felt, are just so important that while I was reporting on them, and that reporting is important, I just felt that this campaign to try to tackle climate change, the healthcare crisis, the wage and the economic crisis in this country, it was just so important. And really, in this primary, there's a very stark choice, and in the entire election, that you've got one candidate, Bernie Sanders, who has put forward the most far-reaching plans to deal with these crises. And we have a chance to actually elect that person president. And so for me, it was basically that was the most important thing I could do in my life to try to better our society, our country, and our world.
We were just showing from the Columbia Journalism Review, Bernie Sanders' op-ed about his plan for journalism. Here it is. You can find it on the CJR.org. Tell me a little bit more about this, because he says he wants to support independent journalism and strengthen media ownership rules so that big media companies can't get bigger.
We have a problem in the media industry in this country, that the media industry is consolidated. I mean, it is very much the ownership is in the hands of a handful of billionaires and corporations. And what that ends up doing, as I've alluded to before, what Bernie Sanders believes it's done, is that, it makes the focus of media coverage not necessarily on the issues of the most importance to the people. So one of the things he's talked about is making sure that antitrust rules are stronger, to make sure that media mergers, major media mergers, are better reviewed. He's also talked about his workplace democracy plan, which would strengthen union rights, workplace rights for people like journalists who can unionize and collectively bargain with their employers, not only for economic benefits, but for protections for their editorial independence. So that's really what that plan is about.
And by the way, I was talking with a Biden aide about this a moment ago. This criticism of all of the candidates in the field, Trump, Biden, Sanders, about their age. You know, Politico has a column this morning titled, 2020 is the dementia campaign. How do you respond to that critique of Sanders? People saying they're just too old to be in the race.
If you try to keep up with Bernie Sanders on the campaign trail, you'll see that Bernie Sanders is in certainly very, very good health. I mean, I've tried to keep up with him on the campaign trail. I'm younger than him, and I'm not going to lie to you. There are times where I find myself exhausted, and he's pushing forward. So the point here is that you have to judge people not just on their age, but on their stamina, on their physical capabilities. And I don't think anybody would argue that Bernie Sanders is weak on the campaign trail. Again, reporters themselves who try to keep up with him. I mean, it is not easy. That guy is an energizer bunny.
David Sirota, thank you so much. Thanks for being here. We have a
Thanks
panel standing
me.
By. Lots more to talk about the Democratic race, Chris Matthews, and much more. Stay with us. The Trump administration has dusted off the White House press briefing room for updates on the coronavirus. Briefings have been happening pretty much every day, although a couple of them were held off camera for no good reason. It is great to see government officials taking questions from reporters, but it is also worth noting the absence of the briefing room's usual occupant, the White House press secretary. Wednesday will be the one-year anniversary of the last formal on-camera White House briefing by a press secretary. These ended during Sarah Sanders' tenure, and they have not come back since Stephanie Grisham took over. Instead, what Grisham does is she does lots of interviews on Fox News instead. Let's talk about this and several other stories with editor-at-large for the nonprofit news organization The 19th, Aaron Haynes, CNN political commentator Joe Lockhart, and Axios media reporter Sarah Fisher. To our former White House press secretary here, Joe Lockhart. The Clinton years, the Obama years, the Bush years, everybody was having press briefings regularly. What is the significance of this ending of the briefing 1 year ago?
Yeah, you know, I think most people out in America don't spend a lot of time thinking about the press briefing, but it really is the removal of one guardrail of our democracy. The fact that every day, Monday through Friday, someone would stand up and take all questions from all comers, from reporters in the briefing room. It's great that they're doing some coronavirus stuff, but there are a lot of other issues out there. And one of the things the press secretary does is kind of run interference or referee within. And my view is if Stephanie Grisham had been doing her job, we wouldn't be getting all these mixed messages on coronavirus. Oh. That there's a discipline that gets instilled in the government, in the interagency process, where the government speaks with one voice.
Interesting.
And now, you know, basically their strategy is you let Trump speak and everyone follows him behind.
And try to clean it up.
Yeah, and yeah. Trump changes his mind. He doesn't tell the truth. And it's, you know, I understand why it's hard. But this is, it's an important thing that's gone away.
One other Trump-related story from this week that I want to note. John Bolton's book, which was supposed to come out on March 17th, it's been delayed till May now because that White House review is still ongoing. Let's turn now to the Democrats and a sense of loss in this primary season. Because, look, we've seen now Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are going at it for the nomination. But the departures this week from Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg. I think, Aaron, there's a real sense of loss a lot of people feel, that this historically diverse field of candidates has now come down to two white guys, two old white guys. I love old white guys, but what happened to the diversity of this field?
Yeah, I think it really raised the question of, you know, who was electable in this country and in a fear election
electability.
Year. Electability, right? Like that word that has loomed over this 2020 Democratic primary. What we saw is that in a fear election, electability has come down to two old white men.
You said in a fear election. Fear, that's interesting.
Yes. I mean, that is really what Democrats are so focused on. They are so fearful of having a candidate that's going to be able to oust President Donald Trump in November. They say that that's their priority. And so the person that they see as being most capable of doing that apparently is going to be, you know, a white man over 70. And that really is just really stark when you think about the diverse field that we had, you know, more candidates of color, more women than we've ever had running at one time in the history of American politics. And yet, you know, we end up here, barely after Super Tuesday. It is really striking. And especially when you consider for the women in particular, the idea that women are the majority of the American electorate, and yet they will not be able to vote for anyone who looks like them after having so many people to choose from a year ago.
And Kamala Harris, one of those people, she, as she endorsed Joe Biden today, also called this out. Let's put her statement on screen. Kamala Harris said, look, it is, she watched with sadness, like a lot of people, she says, we still find ourselves without any women on a path to the Democratic nominee for president. This is something we must reckon with, and it is something I will have more to say about in the future. It's an interesting ending to her statement there. Let's move to one of the other people that dropped out of the race this week, Michael Bloomberg, a media mogul running for president, caused a lot of headaches at his media company, Bloomberg News. And one of the headlines we have on CNN this week is that Bloomberg News staffers are breathing a sigh of relief now that he's out of the race. What do you make of that, Sarah?
Well, I think they don't have to worry about whether or not their credibility is at stake anymore. For a long time, they had to compromise editorially some credibility by not covering him the same way that they would cover potentially other candidates on the right, like Donald Trump. Now they don't have to worry about that. And I think for folks in the press, what we don't have to worry about anymore is it's awkward for us covering Bloomberg News. We have good colleagues and friends there. We know they're great journalists. But we had to cover this really clinically, which was the fact that this is unusual for a newsroom to restrict the coverage of an election because your owner is a billionaire running.
Yeah, so unusual. Another story this week, Chris Matthews suddenly stepping down from MSNBC. This is a situation where he was jumping because he was about to be pushed in the midst of a bunch of controversies there. Aaron, any reaction to that?
Well, certainly that came as a surprise to a lot of folks, just the way that unfolded. And, you know, but really a lot, seeing a lot of praise, too, for just the words that he had to say on his exit, just his awareness of being, you know, somebody of a certain era and of a certain age who understands that the things that he may have said or done were out of step with the moment that we now find ourselves in.
Yeah, journalist
country.
Laura Bassett wrote about being treated inappropriately by Matthews. Other women have described experiences where he would make sexual comments that were inappropriate. You know, this is something that was going on for a long time, and there was a history here, but it looks very different in 2020 than it did, let's say, pre-Me Too. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That's absolutely the way that I think it's being seen and the way that he came to see it and how they came to part ways last week.
Yeah, it is striking to see Chris Matthews, one of the senior statesmen of MSNBC, stepping down at a time, Joe, where we're talking about these older candidates for president.
Right. Yeah, no, and listen, I think in the case of NBC, they had a particular vulnerability given all of the Ronan Farrow stuff and the fact that they killed that story. So I think they were They were ready to do this. There were some erratic comments about Bernie Sanders, which I think went over the line. I think, getting to Aaron's point, for women, I hope they aren't discouraged. I hope they keep they stay in this. This election is, I think, an anomaly. And I know, as the old white guy, it's you don't have to agree with me. People are in the Democratic Party are so afraid of Donald Trump getting a second term and destroying the country that they wanted something that was safe. It's unfair. The coverage of the women in this race was not the same as the men in the race. But at the end of the day, I think the party came to believe that the Joe Biden, maybe it'll be Bernie Sanders, but the people who'd been in it the longest had the best chance of beating Trump. I think that's the single driving force in this race.
Senator Harris's point, like, when will women not be seen as a risk? I think that is a question. In 2016, the woman candidate won the popular vote by 3 million votes. The question of can a woman win, I think, is something that should be settled. And yet it is still very much an open question in our politics.
Mm-hmm. And one thing just to acknowledge about this race, which I thought was interesting, is we had so many women that you heard women saying, I don't want to come out and endorse anyone because it looks like I'm biased against the other woman in the race. And so you have females who aren't getting endorsements from other females. That makes it hard for female voters to believe that those women can go out and win. You saw Emily's List didn't endorse Elizabeth Warren until, 3 days before Super Tuesday. I think that having a multiple candidacy of women actually, in some cases, may have also made it harder.
Boy, it's so interesting. Yeah. I was glad to see the day after Warren stepped aside from the race, front page stories in all the big papers about this issue, about this question, about women being able to make it in these races. It is such a giant story we have to keep paying attention to. All right, to the panel, thank you very much. Quick break here on Reliable Sources. When we come back, Trump's reelection strategy, suing the press. Most of President Trump's attacks against the media are mere words, verbal threats. He has a long history of threatening to sue news outlets. But now his re-election campaign is taking action in the form of libel lawsuits. Three so far, three very similar suits against the New York Times, The Washington Post, and CNN. Each of the lawsuits are over opinion pieces, all of them published last year. Each of the pieces was about Trump and Russia, like this headline from The Post, claiming Trump just invited another Russian attack. The Trump campaign is alleging defamation, saying these sorts of statements have been disproven. But the statements were made in opinion pieces, not in news stories. That's one of the reasons why, as the Wall Street Journal put it, these libel claims are long shots. Legal experts all seem to agree these suits are going nowhere. So what's the motivation then? Does he truly feel defamed, or are these just publicity stunts? In the case of the lawsuit against CNN on Friday, Fox News was tipped off in advance, and Sean Hannity gave it lots of attention. So maybe this is just about making Trump look like a fighter and making the news outlets spend money getting the suits thrown out. Then, of course, the campaign can attack the courts and the media. These suits will likely linger through the campaign season, giving Trump a recurring and convenient line of attack. But even if that's all this is, staging a show, it still comes at a cost. As media law professor Jonathan Peters said, the essence of our political system is public participation, and baseless suits like this one can chill speech about newsworthy political issues, intimidating and discouraging others from speaking out in view of the risk of being sued and the corresponding costs. It's possible these lawsuits are an attempt to appease Trump, or perhaps there's a genuine desire to eventually reach the Supreme Court and revise the country's libel laws. There's clearly some sort of strategy at work here. As the CNN team reported last month, the Trump campaign has shelled out more than $2 million to a law firm known for suing media companies. The firm is Harder LLP, led by Charles Harder, the same lawyer who took on the Gawker website for allegedly invading Hulk Hogan's privacy. Harder won in that case. And, Harder and Trump have something in common. Both men believe America's libel laws should be revised to make it easier for the subjects of news stories to sue and win. We'll see what happens. We'll keep track of it. We will keep covering this court action because that's what the press does, even while being sued. We'll see you back on Reliable Sources this time next week.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.